Today is Thursday. It's May 3rd, 2018. It's 11:13 in the morning, and this is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals. Thank you for that. This is a weekly podcast. We record in the studios at WGN Radio here in Chicago. I hope you like The Rascals and share it with your friends and listen to me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN Radio and Saturday mornings from 10 to noon.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Monday through Friday.
You got that wrong almost.
And I'll call you anytime you want to talk.
Scott Standis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the comic strip Prickly City and co-host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN Plus.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the big boy columnist for the Tribune. I run Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays. I want to point out that The Mincing Rascals is nominated for a Lissagore Award, and it's going to be announced in a little bit more than a week. It's part of the LEGOT, L-E-G-O-T, pantheon of awards that you win in your life, the Lissagore, the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, the Tony. And I think we can get the first leg of that next Friday. So
Is it next Friday?
Yes.
Is someone buying us a table so we can go?
I'm going to be out of town, but I'm going to be watching on cable.
When I heard that we were nominated, I said to Steve Bertrand in a text exchange, well, so is there cash involved in a prize? And he said cash is involved.
Wait, what?
Buying a ticket.
You got to buy a ticket.
Oh, okay.
That's the cash.
And
it's going the wrong way.
I believe cash was involved in the nomination process as well. So yes, cash is involved.
Well,
but the honor of winning, it's an honor just to be nominated, but if we lose, it'll be really crushing.
Yes. Well, I've won four in a row, so
I've won a few, and I've lost others, and just so you guys know, every time I go, I lose. So
Standis is already won, right?
Yes, I'm already a winner.
He's already a winner because there's no other nominees. No one can.
Well, they talk about the EGOT, the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, the Tony.
So the LEGOT. Yes, the LEGOT.
In Trump land, boys, the president continues to rearrange the chairs on the SS Trumptanic. Corey Lewandowski, have you heard, may be back as John Kelly's replacement. Ty Cobb, the attorney, is out on the Trump legal team, and Rudy Giuliani is now in. And Sean Hannity, the president's new legal advisor, said that, yes, $130,000 hush payment was made by Michael Cohen to Stephanie Clifford, Stormy Daniels, but it was not illegal because the money did not come from campaign funds. It came from personal funds, and that, in fact, the president himself reimbursed Cohen for it.
Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation. So
they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh.
Which flies in the face of what he said on Air Force One.
Mr. President, did you know about the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels?
So while Giuliani was trying to put out one fire for the president, my question to you is, did he start another, Eric?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Scott. No, go ahead. Let's start with Scott.
Let's start with Scott. Well, I'm just saying, this is his, I mean, this will infuriate me if the likes of Rush Limbaugh or the others do not jump, because this is his, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. And now Trump is not only saying that he'll pay for it, he's not giving us clear answer as how the money got into his attorney's coffers. It was this part of the...
Well, he tweeted this morning that it was part of a retainer.
Right.
Yeah, but the retainer, as I understand it, is like $30,000 to $35,000 he pays him on retainer to represent him. You do that with an accountant or a lawyer, but that my understanding, Steve, is that he also made Michael Cohen whole for the $130,000. Do you not think that's what happened?
I don't know. I'm just saying that the president said it came out of the retainer. Giuliani said it came over a period of months. So.
Okay, but at the end of the day, the president paid back $130,000.
Well, and said he didn't have sex, but also
he
did not
have
an affair.
But Giuliani, and also Giuliani said he wasn't sure that Trump knew what the money was for. Now, that doesn't pass the smell test.
Well, that's the thing. So Trump tweeted today that it came out of the retainer, so that begs the question, wait, Mr. President, you said on Air Force One that no such payments were made. And so when were you lying?
Well, Rudy Giuliani says he was never.
Well, Giuliani said that he wasn't fully aware of it until maybe within the past 10 days or so.
Right. He makes it sound, and you know, I don't travel in those circles. So maybe it's possible that you've got attorneys who will, at their discretion, drop $130,000 of their money or your money. We won't worry about it. That's peanuts. And they just do that. They just do that. And the president literally didn't know that either his guy was going to do that or that he was going to be on the hook for that. But no
is
harm,
it,
no foul.
Is it plausible at all that Cohen would have, someone would have come
period.
To him and said, I had an affair with the president and I want money. And Cohen didn't go to the president and say, this woman says that you had sex with her. Right. What should we do? That's not plausible. He would just say, oh, let me write you a check because you're making this allegation. That's not plausible. But the bigger question to me is, does anybody, when I say anybody, I mean people who already support Donald Trump, do they care? Do they care that Trump had sex with...
I don't even care, Eric. I still think this,
right.
Particularly now that they're taking it out of the campaign contribution arena. Now it's just private finance.
Maybe.
I know, but that's the box they're trying to put it in now. And therefore, I think it just doesn't matter.
But what pissed people off about Bill Clinton and what got everyone so... frothing at the mouth was when he said, I did not have sexual relations. He lied to us to our faces and on this issue.
But we're used to it.
Scott, the president lies to us. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't want to be that guy, but he does almost every day.
It was 6.5 times a day, right?
Yeah. So,
well, he's
so,
now getting.
And that's the
it,
point.
Well,
it doesn't matter
love
now.
The irony that he's getting Clinton's.
Haven't we all worked with one of those people? It's like, well, it's just that guy.
And, of course, the bigger question I think you glided right over is whether this is a campaign finance violation. I mean, the question is, are people going to really care about that? Now, it could well be that because of the way this money was moving around, that it was a violation, a campaign finance violation. But is anyone going to go to prison for that? Is anyone going to be impeached and removed from office for that? I don't think so. It's scandalous, but I don't think it's so scandalous that it's going to move the needle particularly.
Can we talk about his doctor? A little bit. Are we going to do that?
It's not on my list, but go ahead, Steve. I can put that in the... Actually, this may start to matter more than that. But go ahead.
So his doctor, who, you know... looks weird, you know, he just does. That's okay. So it makes him part of a character. And then he was interviewed last year or 2 years, 3 years ago now, and he released that letter that said the president was nearly superhuman and, you know, this was his report. Now come to find out that the president dictated that letter to him, which is comical until it's not, if you remember that Trump was making an issue of Hillary Clinton's health during the whole campaign, and you have this doctor releasing this phony letter about it. This is one of those, I hate to play that if the roles were reversed, but my God, if the roles were reversed on this and Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama had dictated their doctor's report and had it been released, all hell would be coming out. Now, then this week, this doctor said that the Trump security guy, I can't think of his name, but his name's out there all the time, raided his office and stole the president's health records.
Liberated.
To me, just the hypocrisy of dictating your health report at a time when you're running against someone else is what bothers me. I kind of am with the president on the raiding of the offices in a way. Because this doctor was quoted in the New York Times talking about prescriptions that he gave Donald Trump. You know, it came after the doctor said that, I prescribed Propecia for him.
I couldn't believe anybody was making a big deal about a drug that's to grow his hair, which seemed to be so important. And it certainly is not a breach of medical trust to tell somebody they take Propecia to grow their hair. What's the matter with that?
That's a violation. You can't do that.
Yeah. Propecia is a baldness drug.
I understand that, but if my doctor was doing that, I wouldn't want my records taken from him, too.
It wouldn't matter what the medication is.
Okay, that's all I wanted to say about the doctor.
Well, it's certainly legitimate when the president takes office, he gets a new physician, to have his medical records moved to the new physician. Raiding the office suggests that there's something they're afraid of.
They didn't want to get a release. But, I understand why they went in there to take them. I'm sure that they didn't do it in a courteous way, which I won't defend.
The president's team is anticipating questions that the Mueller team might ask, right? And they have been leaked or released to the New York Times. So I'm asking you guys, what questions would you like Donald Trump to answer? the ones that have been released aren't all that shocking, right? And we suspect that Mueller probably has a pretty good idea of what the answers are anyway.
Okay, can I just say one other thing leading to that?
Yeah.
The president goes on Twitter and calls it, I think the word he used was disgraceful, that these questions were leaked.
Yeah.
They were written by his lawyers.
Yeah, I know.
And
I
that
know.
Just speaks to, does he, how...
You're being that guy, Steve.
How stupid he must think we are.
We need that guy. Well, we need that guy because there are low information people out there who are going to read that and go, wow, Mueller must have leaked those questions.
Exactly.
They're not paying enough attention.
These questions were written by Donald Trump's lawyer.
For lunch. I mean, really, isn't it amazing how the Mueller team has evidently kept mum on all of the things they are doing, knowing, not doing, or not knowing. I mean, it's amazing to me.
Well, what's amazing to me, too, is that both camps, you know, hate Trump, like Trump, have already made their decision as to what this report is all about. In fact, and it's ridiculous. You can't say that because you don't know what it's going to say.
We're going to be so... The people who want Trump out of office are going to be so disappointed by this report.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because they're putting so much stock in it. They're writing it themselves. And they like Scott says, you can't do that.
Well, besides, Mueller doesn't get to impeach the president. I mean, I think the people that are going to be disappointed want an agenda, and you're not going to get it. I mean, you might, but it's still, even however damning it is, it's not the place of the special prosecutor to impeach the president. It's the place of the Congress.
So if we were, you asked us, what question would we ask?
I have a list. Go ahead,
I
Scott.
Have one. My number one on my list is to President Donald Trump is, what the hell is wrong with you?
Okay, here's mine. Top five favorite movies.
Oh, come on.
No, I am serious. What did you know? When did you know it? Blah, blah, blah. Right? But literally, for a guy who tries so hard to be so transparent about his feelings, about his ego, about his needs. It's amazing to me that we don't know what his top five favorite movies are, or his favorite TV shows that he was not in, or his best parent memory with his kids.
I would challenge him to name his four children.
An embarrassing fear he has. Steve Cochran on his show this week was asking listeners to say, what are you afraid of? And it was, being in a car crash or walking on a manhole cover. We all have them. Wouldn't it humanize him? Wouldn't you love to know, if you think about it for a minute, I wonder what his childhood or his fear is today. If you could change anything about yourself now, what would it be? These are the sort of Proust questionnaires that you see. If you could change anything about yourself as a younger person, what would it be? What books are on your bedside table right now?
What books have you ever read besides books that you have ostensibly
Describe
written?
Describe for me your dream salad. I don't know.
We saw that on Cinco de Mayo.
Yes.
That's right. Thumbs up. I would love to know the answers to some of those questions.
The president in 2016 in the summer was at a podium, and he said, wait till you see, we're going to have a big announcement coming. It had to do with Hillary Clinton. Maybe Monday, maybe coming up soon. It's going to come, and wait till you hear what we're going to say or have to say. And he said that in the days before the Trump Tower meeting with his sons and the Russians. I would like to know what he meant when he said that and what he knew.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
I'm genuinely curious to make fun of him for not maybe reading enough, but I don't think that he does read anything, that he doesn't know anything particularly, that he's all about gut instinct. And I'd like to give him like a basic current events quiz about things that are going on in like the coal industry that he can says he cares so much about. I don't think that he understands any of these issues. I don't think he understands healthcare, anything more than a very basic...
And now you're talking like John Kelly.
What do you mean by that?
Well, John Kelly said that, right? That the president doesn't even understand DACA when he defends it. NBC story called that he's, referred to him...
Oh, yeah,
someone who wasn't very smart. Yeah.
I believe that he is an idiot, as John Kelly reportedly said. I think that he doesn't understand basic things. Now, that doesn't mean that he doesn't have certain kind of street smarts, but when it comes to knowledge about what's actually going on in the world, I think he's fundamentally ignorant. Is that unfair? I mean, I'm looking at...
I think that's pretty spiteful. I get your point, but I think it's so exaggerated.
I think he's glaring.
There's not a lot of currency.
I think
in that,
if you
Eric.
Take the word ignorant as in not stupid, but just unknowing or unaware, or I think that applies.
I would say he is glaringly incurious.
Yeah, that's the problem.
There's a good one.
That's the problem. I guess the fruit of that would be what Eric is talking about, but I don't I get your point, Eric. I just don't know how bad it is.
It sounds harsher than I mean it.
Yeah, but it does.
you're ignorant. You're an idiot. But I don't mean that.
Let's say it this way: he's incurious, and that leads to ignorance. Look, I'm ignorant of jet air and jet engines. I just am. I'm not aware of them, and I think in that way, he's not aware of a lot of things he's ruling over.
Okay, I want to just bring up Kanye West for a second.
Speaking of ignorant.
And that is his interview on TMZ Live.
When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all? You know, like, it's like we're mentally in prison.
He later said that's not what he meant about slavery being a choice, but his fix, I don't think, made things much better. Anyway, in the Chicago Tribune, columnist Darlene Glanton said about Chicago's temperamental superstar artist Kanye West, if he had bothered to research the history of his people, he would realize that African Americans have much to be proud of for having survived such a painful thing as slavery. The hashtag, if slavery was a choice, is now trending. What do you other white people say about this?
How do you host a radio talk show when you take these low-hanging bits of fruit and say they don't matter? This is just what people are talking about, John. I mean,
I know they were talking about it, Eric.
Kanye West.
Really?
We had this conversation last week. Kanye West is this major cultural figure, this artistic genius, and he's saying these incredibly stupid things. I mean, it was something spectacularly ignorant. And so you talk about it, and you point out, and this further erodes the credibility that he has, and reminds us not to pay any attention to him.
Of Kanye West.
Yeah.
In the same interview.
I'm sorry, I have to get this.
In the same interview, for instance, he stood up and said to the assembled crowd that he had been on, what was the opioids? And that it was his hope that he was going to lose weight as a result, and he did that for y'all.
I got liposuction. Because I didn't want y'all to call me fat like y'all called Rob at the wedding. I was addicted to opioids. 2 days I got off of opioids, I'm in the hospital.
I mean, he was just acting kind of cuckoo.
Roseanne Barr's an artist, right?
Sure.
How much do you pay attention to her opinions?
I don't know what the answer to that's supposed to be.
Not much.
Okay.
And so Kanye West can be both an artist and someone to whom I will pay no attention to.
Yeah, but it sets such a terrible example, not just because of what he said was stupid, just a wanton lack of basic history of knowledge of history. And that's what this, our culture is stricken with this. I'm sorry, there is a bigger issue here.
That's Darlene's point, too, by the way.
Is it?
Well, yeah, that, sure, but keep going.
No, that's it. Is that, you know, this, as I said, a wanton disregard for anything that happened before I was born. Is it just, anyone who doesn't understand history is doomed to repeat it, so.
You know, I guess where I was
You said that last week.
I'm sorry I wasn't here for it, and you can tell I didn't listen to last week's podcast. I guess my point, though, Eric, was the relationship between Kanye and Trump I don't think matters much. I'm interested in this dialogue about race and our ignorance about slavery, but I'm not going to Kanye West anyway for
right.
sort of backdrop on that. Speaking of race relations, here in Illinois, the state Senate approved a bill. The state Senate here in Illinois approved a bill that would require public schools to teach LGBT history. The same way we learn about minority groups in school, the travails of African-Americans or Hispanics or Asian-Americans, so too should we learn about the LGBT community. The Illinois Family Institute said this is proof that the left is, quote, trying to normalize homosexuality. Well, of course they are, but he makes it, or they make it sound like a bad thing. Is this bill a good thing or a bad thing, Steve?
Well, it's not a bad thing. And
teaching
maybe,
LGBT
right, and maybe
issues
it's a good thing. I don't know if it's a needed thing. I understand the goal of it, maybe.
You only have so many hours of the day in school, right?
Well, right, and so there's that. And I think even though we might think they're on the wrong end of it, we do owe religious groups who are opposed to gay marriage and other issues. I don't know what I'm going to end up saying here, but I mean, this is offensive to their religion. And so maybe there should be a little more sensitivity to that in public schools while still allowing for all. Was there a point there?
I'm shocked that you are arguing that the public schools should respect a religious view when deciding their curriculum.
Yeah,
right?
Me
That's
too.
What you're saying.
Maybe, yeah. I want more time on this one.
Okay,
I don't
we'll come
know.
Back to
yeah.
you in several years.
Pass on that. Now, here's, have a bunch of thoughts on this. One is I don't like the idea of Springfield in general micromanaging school curricula in various places. I don't think they should be getting into all this stuff about moments of silence and everything else that they manage to meddle in down there in Springfield. I don't think they're qualified. On the other hand, I think that it's a good idea to teach about LGBTQ history. I guess there's no Q in the...
They didn't have it in there, but sometimes people do.
But I think it's a good idea to teach that. There is also a problem with it, which is that when you go back very far in history, when you go back more than a few decades, there's a lot of people who we now suspect or think might have been gay or gender binary, whatever, but to go back and retrospectively out them to make a political point or make a social point, say, well, we think that this person might have been gay. We think that, let's just take,
Abraham Lincoln?
Well, Abraham Lincoln or Eleanor Roosevelt, people who think
Thomas Jefferson.
They might have had gay lovers, something like that. Do we do that? Do we go back and out them? And do we frame it the way we would frame it today? I think that we don't. I think this is a problem. I think that to be able to say in our history text to talk about the gay rights movement, yes, we should talk about the gay rights movement. We should talk about the social movement that led to the legalization of gay marriage. Of course, that's part of contemporary history. To ignore that is irresponsible. But to go back in history and say, well, we think that Abraham Lincoln, another good example, like we think that Abraham Lincoln had a gay male lover. We don't know that to be the case, and just to say that we do in order to prove a historical point or to make some sort of a social point, I think is wrong as a matter of education. I will now yield the floor to Scott Stanis.
I was just stunned to learn that they still teach history.
Is a way to sneak history back into the curriculum.
I think you know, they need to have a basic understanding of human history. LGBT is, I bring it into the contemporary times, as Eric mentioned, that modern history, the Stonewall Uprising, I think the legalization, the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage, those are important things to learn and know that they happened. But to have a curriculum on it, I'm with Eric. I think having Springfield or any capital tell schools what their curriculum should or should not be is
okay.
I'd like to
enough.
Amend my remarks to echo those of Mr. Stantis and Mr. Zorn, please.
Wow. Well, thank you for that thoughtful insight, Steve. So if the state, though, cedes control of that to the local school board, which I think is what they want to do anyway, and the local school board decides to have a curriculum that covers this, the question's still in play. Should they or should they not? I guess it would not be a history, but it'd be a civics class for high school seniors.
Stonewall is part of the 20th century history, and it's an
important
part. I
wouldn't teach LGBTQ issues in a history class.
Not issues.
It would be something more contemporaneous, like civics, or I don't know what you would be teaching. I'm not sure this belongs in the curriculum anyway. For one thing, Steve, maybe to your point, I think in order to teach this, you end up having to vilify somebody. And it might be somebody who's sitting in class and whose parents very much disagree with the position you're taking, even though it's legal. They still feel it's wrong.
If you can't teach history like that without ladling your values onto it. If you can say, okay, here is the issue with gay marriage. Here's how it evolved. Going from Stonewall to legalization of gay marriage or the Supreme Court decision, you can talk about the various sides. You can talk about what happened without saying, well, these people were bad and these people were good.
You can? Really? I want to hear you do that.
I think you can. In a history class, in a high school history class, yes, you can.
You can try, but I'm just – would you agree with me that the challenge would be – impressive. I mean,
the default would be the good guys won. And so it'd be hard to teach that class and make it say,
things any way they want to hear them, too, right? I mean, you're going to be teaching this class and you know you've got your I's dotted and your T's crossed. And then someone's going to come home and tell their mom and dad they said that LGBTQ is okay or that the Christian view of it is wrong. And now you have a school board meeting. I mean, that will happen.
Well,
right?
It's going to happen. But, I think that is a pedagogical skill to be able to teach a class and let the students talk about what's going on. But tell them, give them the points, the landmark points in history to then talk about this issue or to learn about it without saying at the end, and the good guys won and the Christians had to go home and lick their wounds. I don't think you have to say that.
So you could teach it as if it's this incursion, and then the gays did this, and then they did this, and now they've got that.
They got their gay agenda.
I mean, that would be the reverse way of the way we expect it to be taught. And then the rights were expanded, marriage was included and all that, and we're all happily ever after.
Okay, well then, speaking of the schools, the Village Leadership Academy is a private school in the South Loop area of Chicago. And a teacher there, Bianca Jones, is teaching her kids history and about activism.
At our school, we also think it's important for students to engage in a social activism curriculum.
So it's not always this cause per se.
No. So each year, students decide what campaign or what issue they would like to address.
They have been doing train takeovers where the fifth graders board the L and they ask passengers to sign a petition to change the name of Douglas Park. Douglas Park is named after one-time Illinois Senator Stephen A. Douglas, whose family owned slaves. The students want to change the name from Douglas with one S to Douglas with two S's, thereby honoring former slave activist and orator Frederick Douglass. Are you guys signing the petition when they get on your L?
I'm signing the petition so they'll get off my L car. Nothing more irritating to me than someone getting on my L car and asking for my attention.
Now let's add that to the curriculum.
Fifth Don't grader. Use my L car. I want to read or listen to
Grumpy
podcasts.
Old Man 101.
10-year-olds are doing this, L. And it sounds like they're doing it well.
So I brought up in the past, you know, when a statue or when something becomes that in and of itself, was it Meigs Field or Balbo? When does Balbo become our Balbo and not the original Balbo, right? So I tend to lean toward, I don't like erasing names in that way. I love this solution. I hadn't heard this story.
Too. Put so an then, S on the statue.
So then the people for who all their lives said they lived in Douglas Park still can say that, but the Douglas is changed.
You've added an extra S.
Well, no, but you can, or say it proudly, but then it doesn't erase Douglas Park, you know, or the, you know, I used to play in Douglas Park, or I grew up near Douglas. You can still
say that.
But
you're interested in the phonics of this?
I mean, yeah.
It's a different park, Steve. It's a different park.
But
now.
See, that's the thing. It's not. It's the same park, and it's the same ish name. I am interested in the phonics a little bit. I don't like the disappearing of places, you know, and if you disappeared Balbo or something like that, even though generations of us have known it and having nothing to do with the original Balbo. If we disappeared Douglas Park and all of the people who grew up around Douglas Park now had to say, I grew up around Emmanuel Field, it used to be Douglas Park, I don't like that.
Steve, this all comes up with Jackson Park. Because Andrew Jackson was such an awful guy in so many ways, we could just say it's now Bo Jackson.
Exactly,
that would
work.
I thought Michael Jackson.
And Steve,
would be a problem.
And Steve's logic is, well, there it's the same park.
That's true.
And I'm like, no, that's a different park.
By the way, it would be Jesse Jackson Park,
Junior.
It is the same park, John. It's the same physical place.
Well, Steve, it's no one's ever suggested that you bulldoze parks. I mean, maybe we take down some statues.
It's the same issue. Steve is right. It's the same issue. What do we do with this history that we're uncomfortable with that we have honored in this way? It's the same issue that dealt with all the Civil War statues, right? With all Robert E. Lee statues that got people in Charlottesville so exercised.
All right, let's do our recommendations, things that you guys are reading, consuming, suggesting for people watching, listening to. How about you, Scott?
Okay. I'm just finishing up Ron Chernow's Washington, A Life, the story about George Washington. Ron Chernow is also the same author of Hamilton, of famous musical fame. And while I reviewed Hamilton a million years ago, and I said, you know, it's a little dense, it's a little long, about two-thirds of the way through it, you just say, just shoot them already. and this biography is kind of the same way. It's very dense, but if you don't know a heck of a lot about Washington, and I didn't know nearly enough, this helps get you there. It's a single volume. Ron Chernow's Washington, A Life.
There is a book of Chernow's Hamilton where they abridged it significantly, I believe. You can buy that on Amazon, which sounded very appealing to me, actually, because it sounds like a good book, but I don't want to read the whole thing.
Well, they're hard to read. They're heavy and bad. You're just lying there.
Kindle.
So I want to recommend a show that's completely opposite. I saw it on Amazon when I was trolling for shows last week, and it's called David and Olivia, and Olivia is followed by a question mark. And it's only three episodes, and they're about 25 minutes each, and it opens with this guy, David, getting in his car in Scotland to drive to the airport, I think in Glasgow, to bring his girlfriend her passport because she forgot. So he's about 10 minutes into the drive and he realizes that there's a naked woman in the back of his car. And this woman, who may or may not be named Olivia, she's covered with just an envelope that we find out later is filled with cash and guns. And it's three episodes of the two of these people talking in the car. And it's very funny. It turns out the guy's a henpecked boyfriend, and all sorts of things happen. 3 25-minute episodes. You can kick it out pretty quickly. I can't wait to see where they are next, because it just was a good show. It's called David and Olivia.
It's on Amazon. Amazon. Eric Zorn, what do you like this week?
I like that. There's a podcast out called Empire on Blood. It's a limited, I think it's 7 episodes, and it's by a guy. The host is a guy named Steve Fishman. I used to work with him with the Miami Herald many years ago. He now is a bar owner and journalist in New York City, and he follows this criminal case of a guy named Cal Bowari, who was a crack dealer in the 90s in New York City. And he was one of these terrible people who really brought the crack epidemic to the city. And he was accused and convicted of a double murder. And so Fishman follows his appeals and follows his case and really gets totally involved in reinvestigating the crime. And it has a more satisfying ending and more interesting ending than, say, Serial, which is a very popular true crime podcast also. It's a really nice version of these true crime podcasts that you listen to, these, you know, limited series where they tell a story in an interesting way. And again, it's also, you know, you feel sorry for this guy, Cal, because you feel like he's been wrongly convicted, but you also kind of hate him for everything that he has done in this past. So it's a morally ambiguous, interesting journey right into the heart of this crime. So
Does it take a position on the guilt or innocence?
It does, yes.
And maybe we should listen to the podcast.
It's Steve Fishman's the host, and it's Empire on Blood on your iTunes.
My recommendation, we just, as I mentioned to you, got back from a trip, and on the trip, we were in the airplane, we watched a bunch of movies, at least I did. So I finally watched Phantom Thread, the Daniel Day-Lewis movie.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I really like that movie. If you have not yet watched Phantom Thread, and I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, I guess you'll figure that out in the first 10, 15 minutes of the movie, if it is yours. But I think it's brilliantly written. It's brilliantly acted.
Describe it.
Phantom Thread is the story of a dressmaker played by Daniel Day-Lewis, who is idiosyncratic and then some. It's about his business of making dresses and the relationship he strikes up with a woman who wears them elegantly and becomes his lover and eventually wife. I'll tell you this about the movie. The last 10 minutes blew my mind. And I turned to my wife and son, who had previously seen it, and I said, "You didn't tell me about how the movie's going to end?" They said, "We wanted you to wait and see." I said, "Did it end the way I thought it ended? Is that what's happening here?" And they go, "Yep." Holy cow. Rosebud, the Phantom Thread.
Rosebud was his sled. Oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Zorn.
Eric. Thanks.
What a jerk.
So there's no spoilers in this podcast. Thank you, Eric Zorn and Scott Stantis. Steve Bertrand, we normally enjoy the company of Kristen McQuarrie. She'll join us again soon. That's Ben Cortez, Engineering, The Mincing Rascals, produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to The Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNRadio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.